Mantle and PCMC. I'm your host, Mike Bongiorno. This is a podcast that is all about pop culture, TV, video games, movies, comic books, toys, everything. This podcast you're about to hear, I recorded with my brother, Anthony Bongiorno. And I did something which I've done before, which is I mistakenly thought I was recording and I wasn't. I'm an idiot. This has happened a few times before. We recorded basically half the episode and then realized we weren't recording and had to sort of backtrack and start again. So what you're about to hear is, well, we have very weird energy because we're discombobulated, maybe even a little defeated, but you don't miss any of our content because we go back over our list of underrated movie sequels. That is the topic of today's episode. Underrated sequels. Sequels that came out that did not get their due. So, Pop Culture Man Children is available anywhere podcasts are found. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and share. So, without further ado, here is underrated sequels.
This is Pop Culture Man Children. We are recording this. I did something that I've done before.
You're a dummy.
Like a fucking idiot. I wasn't recording. My recording, you have to press it. You press it once to make the mics go on, and then the red light blinks, and then you press it again to record.
Son of a bitch.
And we did
30 minutes.
We did half the episode. You would have loved it. So
what is it? Now it's just the conversation we had.
Yeah, we just talked to each other without a fucking microphone. That's disgusting. So, fuck. What do we say? All right, so your list was more... Your list was... We both did five. Your list was least to most hot take.
Yes.
Right? Mine is just random ones. All right. Tell me your first one again.
All right.
Don't feel any necessity to try to
repeat.
I feel
like I'm trying to repeat everything I said. All right. So my first one is Grease 2.
Which I think is kind of ridiculous. But you think it has good music. Tell us again why you think this is a choice that makes any sense.
I think it's got great music. I think it's got...
I'm going to disagree with you on that.
I think... But why? Like, what songs do you not like?
I don't like any of the songs. I don't like Cool Rider.
How do you not like Cool Rider?
I don't think any of the songs...
Cool Rider is the best Grease song. Of the franchise.
Of all of Grease.
Of the franchise.
No.
You're wrong. It is one... It could have been a pop hit on its own.
I mean, it's got a better message, right?
The movie?
Yeah, it does. Because the first movie kind of ends with, like, change yourself.
It's way cooler, and it's way more, like, feminist, and Michelle Pfeiffer's, Stephanie Zanoni's a great character. Okay. But I like Do It For Our Country, Reproduction,
I think those
Back
are,
to School.
I think
those
the
are
songs are
songs.
Stupider.
They're sillier.
Right.
But that's okay. The Grease 1 is kind of silly, too. I think a lot of people revere Grease 1 too much. Grease 1's got problems.
All right. So I... said that so then I went
I like that we're just recapping a conversation that nobody's gonna hear,
like, it's gonna, so the people listening, they're like, well, we okay.
I wanted to hear you talk more
Muppets
about that.
Muppets Most Wanted, which is, you could argue that there's a lot of Muppet movies, but this is really is a sequel to The Muppets, which was the reboot with Amy Adams and Jason Segel. And I would argue it's a sequel to that because that movie introduces a new human Muppet, or like a Muppet, I forget what it was.
His brother is a Muppet.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But he was raised with humans, he wants to be a Muppet. He feels like those are his people. And that character...
And there's that song, Man or Muppet, which was nominated for an Oscar.
Right. Insane. So that character is in Muppets Most Wanted. And Muppets Most Wanted, I think, is funnier. It's got Tina Fey. It's got my favorite line where Danny Trejo plays a small character in it, and you think, like, he's a character, then, like, she's just like... they're in prison and she's like, good night, Danny Trejo. It's like, wait, he's playing himself.
Good night, Fozzie. Good night, Kermit. Good night, Danny Trejo.
That meme that was big a couple years ago with Kermit, evil Kermit talking to regular Kermit, and it became a meme for, like, you, the dark side of you talking to the light side of you, comes from this movie. And the evil Kermit's funny.
Hello, Fonzie.
He calls Fozzie Bear Fonzie, which is hilarious.
That is, it's really good. I think it's way better than the Jason Segel, Amy Adams Muppets, like, by a lot.
I think it's way better than Grease 2. Listen, do you think Grease 2 is an actual good movie, or it's,
yes,
going with our premise, it's an underrated sequel?
Well, do we have that on the record?
No.
All right, so let's back up. We said last time around that yeah. some of these titles are not necessarily, especially on my list, they're not necessarily good movies, but they are worthy of more than they got, I guess, or worthy of another look.
I'm going to say that only one movie on my list is not necessarily good.
But I was going to, I put Grease 2 at the end of my list because I feel it's the least controversial, because I do think that a lot of people like it. And I think it's really, I think it's a good movie.
Yeah.
I think it's like a worthy sequel to Grease.
Yeah. And we haven't said,
I like it better.
This is Pop Culture Man Children. I'm the host, Mike Bongiorno.
We're all turned around.
This is my brother, Anthony Bongiorno. He's co-hosting.
Yo.
Thanks for being here, Anthony.
Thank you for having me in my house.
We didn't we have such amazing points in the first episode? We were like articulate. It was maybe the best episode we ever had.
You guys would have loved it.
Oh my God. It's way better than what this has been, right? This is fucking shit. Okay. Tell me your next one.
All right. So my next one is Scream 4.
Now, I pointed out.
Now, what I said 20 minutes ago.
No, what I said was, this was during my not sober time. So I was super high when I saw Scream 4.
Wow, you're really
going
to say that again?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought maybe you'd take a different course this time around.
No. I'm, you know, it's all about truth for me. So I don't remember it. And Anthony says I didn't like it. I remember liking it.
No,
but
you
I
didn't.
I don't remember it.
It's funny that you just don't remember it.
I was.
We saw it together, yeah. And I remember the minute it ended, people clapped because we saw it the midnight before,
right?
The opening day, people were clapping and people were like, "Oh my God, that's so good!" And I remember you saying specifically, because I remember thinking it was a weird thing to say, and now that I know you were high, it makes sense that you said it. You said it was kind of weak sauce, don't you think? And I was like, "Weak sauce? What the
weak
fuck?
Weak sauce?"
So that was high, Mike. Saying, I initially you thought that it was weak.
Explain what you like about the opening, though.
I think that the opening is, so the opening is, it starts with the first kill, but then you find out that that's the stab movie that characters are watching. And then there's another kill, and then that's a stab movie that had a stab movie reference in it. And then finally, you're in the Scream movie.
Right.
The universe of the actual movie. So it's like it's very, very meta. It's like the first kill, but it's like each one is like shoved up the other
one's
ass. It's
the most clever.
Like a Russian doll of first kills.
Yeah.
It's a very clever opening.
It's a very clever first kill. I think this part two has a very clever, maybe the best part of part two is the first kill, because they're in the theater watching the beginning. That is like a remake.
Scream is a very meta series.
Right.
And I think Scream 3.
Has Jay and Silent Bob in it?
Well, Scream 3 is Scream 3
and
is
Carrie Fisher.
Is meta, but it goes into the hot to the like the filmmaking side of it, which is boring.
The killer of Scream 3 is a director who's the half brother.
Yeah, it's so soap opera and like Scooby Doo ish. And then there is all that shitty humor in it, like Carrie Fisher saying like I could have been Princess Leia. It's like. Even though I love Carrie Fisher, like it's bad writing.
Yeah, it's a fucking bad one.
Yeah, and the Jane Thomas Bob part is just
why?
Last time we didn't shit on Kevin Smith, but this time we are.
And also, you know, one thing I like about the opening is when I saw it, I was in getting my master's degree, so I was into philosophy. Postmodern philosophy. So it's a lot like
humble brag.
It's a lot more. Listen, it's a lot like Simulation and Simulacra, which is by Jean Baudrillard. If you've ever seen The Matrix, when Neo opens his desk door, you see a copy of it in there, which is a sort of hint on what the movie's about.
The Simulacrum inspired The Matrix, didn't it?
Yes. So the idea,
I read pieces of it in college.
Yeah.
I remember the part about Disneyland.
Yes, like Disneyland is the most real place on Earth because it acknowledges that it's fake.
Yeah.
The idea of Simulation Simulacrum is when you copy something and you keep copying it, you'll eventually lose reality. Like in the book, they talk about the map maker fairy tale where there's a kingdom and then the king goes to a map maker and says, can you make a map that's the actual size of the kingdom and put it over the kingdom? And they do that, but then people forget that that's a map. So they keep making more maps on top of it.
Yeah.
Like that's the sort of metaphor there. And that's, you could see where the Matrix comes from that. I like that in the beginning of Scream 4, but now that I'm remembering more about it, I read that there was a line in the original script that's not in the movie.
Yes, which was a good line.
That I feel like would have been, it would have taken it to fucking a better, it would have made it so much more clever, which is, you just said the opening, you know, it's a movie, and then, oh, okay, it's a movie. Oh, it's a movie within a movie. And then the last thing is like, this is the real world. Here's the real first kill. But there's a line of dialogue where in the last part of the last section where the real girl is being really killed, she says to the killer, is this real life?
No, she says, this, but you're not real.
But you're not real.
Right.
Which is totally Baudrillardian fucking philosophy. Yeah,
I don't know why they cut that out.
It's so fucking clever because it's like she living in the real world, she like copies of copies makes you lose reality. So right. Like she even doesn't even the fact that she's being killed, she's like, this can't be real. So well, I really it's wish because
they're the Woodsboro kids, but they grew up in the world of like there was this thing that happened before they were born.
Yeah.
That movies are based on.
Yeah.
And to them it's not real.
Yeah.
It's just the movies.
And
what's ironic about that is that the murders themselves were inspired by horror movies.
Right.
So it's yeah, it's yeah. Very. I think Scream 4 is, it's got its problems, but I think it's very clever. That opening is really, really strong. I like the new kids. My one complaint, as I said before, is that none of the new kids survived. So
right.
They left. It kind of was like a one and done. Like they left no opening for a sequel.
Right. And as I said before,
this is really like the simulacrum. We're trying to relive.
Oh my God, we did it on purpose. Moment. We did this on purpose. This is a podcast of a podcast of a podcast. What I said before was one of the main three should have died. Neve Campbell, David Arquette. It should
have been David Arquette, I think.
Or Courtney Cox. One of the three. Because they survive all four, and it's like, come on.
Yeah. Two it would have been interesting to kill Neve Campbell.
Two was daring enough to kill Jamie Randy. Kennedy's character, and then they never were daring enough again.
Three killed Liev Schreiber. Which
yeah,
that was interesting because that was the opening kill. Was a character you already knew. That was the first,
and
time
he was
that
somebody
happened.
Who was now had become famous because he was wrongly.
That's
accused
probably the
of
only
killing.
Good part of Scream 3 is that first kill.
Scream 3 has interesting ideas in it, but
it's so bad.
But Scream between Scream 1 and Scream 2, Columbine happened, and that's I know that's like 1,000 mass shootings ago, but.
That was the big deal.
So, yes, that's why Scream 2 and 3 are very tame in terms of gore.
But Scream 4 is a return to form. There's a lot of violence in it.
Right. You
bloody kills.
Right. You were talking before about there's a scene that I kind of remember through my haze of highness where there's a scene where a girl's being killed
yes.
in her bedroom.
So the scene, I'll go deeper into it now since we're doing this again. The scene was Emma Roberts, who, spoiler alert, turns out is one of the killers.
Right.
But Emma Roberts is in her room with Hayden Panettiere and she's talking on the phone across the alley to her friend's house who lives next door.
Which is kind of a Nightmare on Elm Street reference.
Yes. And he's like, I'm in the closet. And then they open the closet and he's not there. And Hayden Panettiere is like, you're a liar. And he's like, I didn't say it was your closet. And then across the way, they see him come out of her closet.
Yeah.
And it's a huge shock. And then he kills her really violently. And like, it's really kind of relentless. Like the camera doesn't move away. Yeah. And it's really bloody. And I was saying that I think that's the best kill in the series since the KC. Her character was Casey. The Drew Barrymore kill.
Right. Because the Drew first Barrymore one. Is gutted in
yeah,
the first one.
That first yeah, that's iconic Scream.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got its weak kills. Like the Alison Brie kill, the whole Alison Brie character and kill is horrible.
So pointless.
And boring and pointless. But that one was really and that almost feels like it was added later, like the principal
yes,
from
yes,
the
yes.
first one.
Yeah, and every Scream movie tried to add some technology. Like Scream 1. He calls and he's menacing on the phone and then he comes out and kills you. Scream 2, he has now a voice box in his mask so he can speak while in person.
Yeah,
with
and that's
you.
Horrible now it's, looking back. It's, right here.
Yeah. And Scream 3, his voice box now is fucking magical and can do anybody's
do any
voice. So there's a lot of like
you
faking
think you're
you
on the phone
and,
with Sydney, but it's actually
right.
a killer.
And then in the fourth one, and they don't even really go far with this.
They should.
He's like recording it all because yeah. it's sort of like a YouTube-y kind of streaming. But they kind of touch on that idea and then don't really deliver
well,
on it.
Well, because the thing with Scream 4 is they say like, well, this time around he's recording the kills and putting them on the internet.
Right, it's going to be viral.
Which, and we talked before about how like Scream 2 is so 90s because the motivation is like the they tie it to OJ and it's like the trial is where they're going to get
right.
the fame.
The motivation in
four. Well, for one of That's Mickey's motivation. But then Laurie Metcalf kills him, and she's like, that's a stupid motive. It's really just because you killed my son.
Right, right. Which is sort of a Friday the 13th kind of
yeah.
homage.
Isn't it crazy that Laurie Metcalf is one of the Ghostface... What's interesting about Scream as a
series... She's like 90 pounds. How did she kill all
those people? I know. What's interesting about Scream as a series is it's the only like slasher series where like Ghostface is always different people.
Right. So like when they make like Ghostface action figures...
Yeah, it's like which... There have been like 8 Ghostfaces.
It's like a concept.
Yeah, it was Stu... Who was it?
Billy and Stu.
Billy and Stu. Then it was Laurie Metcalf and Mickey.
Right. Who's, and then... Who's... What's his name? Who's a big star now?
Yeah.
He was just in Once Upon a Time.
Timothy Olyphant.
Oliphant, yeah.
Oliphant. Then the third one was just her brother.
Right, just one guy.
Although...
And he's a movie director, which is sort of kind of interesting.
They also tried to do some retconning where they said that he was responsible for Billy and Stu as
right,
well.
Right, right. Like, he gave them the idea, which kind of is cool yeah. until you think that it makes no fucking sense.
And then four is Emma Roberts and Kieran Culkin.
And what's interesting about Emma Roberts... So there have been
7 ghost faces altogether.
What's interesting about Emma Roberts is she's not really the protagonist of the movie. The protagonist is still Neve Campbell. But in
her world,
in her world, she is the victim. So like, right. And she plays Sydney's cousin, yeah. Neve Campbell's cousin. So it's like, what if the protagonist actually is the killer? But she's not the protagonist, right. really, of the movie.
It's also weird
Scream
then
4.
Because when you think of all four of them together, it's like, so Sydney's brother killed her mother and tried to kill her. Then her cousin killed her aunt and tried to kill her. So it's like a really family... It's like a family
yeah,
drama.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's
because her aunt does. Emma Roberts kills her own mother in it.
There's also been a Scream TV series.
Oh,
and then they recently rebooted it again. But like,
wasn't it Supernatural?
Oh,
didn't
God,
have
I don't
Supernatural
know.
Elements.
It didn't have the mask.
Really?
The MTV one. But then they just redid it again on like VH1, and it did have the mask.
Who the fuck watches that?
But people said it was really bad. The only interesting thing I heard about it is. The VH1 series was predominantly an African-American cast, which okay. is sort of interesting because African-American people were not in the movies that much.
What's interesting about that is, that now that you bring that up, they were so underrepresented in the Scream movies that they even, like, the first kill of Scream 2 is, like, a comment on the fact that the first one has no diversity.
Right, right, right.
But then the rest of the movie goes on with only white characters.
Right, right.
Predominantly white characters.
You could only... Scream as a series kept getting worse because you... Cleverness is
it's a cheap.
Depreciating
yeah.
You know,
there's
the
diminishing
value
returns
of it. Exactly.
Yeah.
By the time you're doing the fourth one, yes, you could go, aren't horror movies shitty that they have so many sequels? And it's like, yeah, but
what I think what they should have explored more in Scream 4 is the way they sold it, which was like, it was supposed to be like, this is how you do... These are the rules of a horror reboot.
Right.
The horror reboot doesn't follow the rules. Right. And the main character can die in a horror reboot.
Right.
Because it was during the time of horror reboots.
Right.
But they never... They kind of abandoned that halfway through the movie.
But even in Scream 2 and 3, the
They're
whole
like, oh,
rules
it's a
thing
copycat,
made no sense.
And then the rules, they dropped that too.
Right. Right.
Remember there's that whole scene in Scream 2 where they're like, oh, their names match up.
And
but
they
then
completely
it never
give that
comes
up.
To anything. Yeah.
Well, remember in Scream fucking 3, Randy made a video before he died
yeah.
of a trilogy rules.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
like, first of all, how many horror trilogies
there
can you
There are
even
no
think
horror
of?
Trilogies, yeah. Anyway, all right, so what's your next one?
So the next one I did, which is not a shock to you because we did it already.
But it's our first crossover because I have it on my list also.
Yeah, The Exorcist Part 3. It's... The Exorcist Part 3 is written and directed by the author of the Exorcist book, William Peter Blatty. And
based on his book, Legion.
Right, which
is
a
spinoff of
right.
The Exorcist.
It's the detective character from The Exorcist, who's really a Kinderman. Small character in The Exorcist. He's just the one... He's just investigating the death of the director, who... very early on in the story, Reagan throws out the window.
Yeah. Burke.
Yeah.
But then he strikes up a friendship with Damien Karras.
Right, right, right. In The Exorcist 3, it's a sort of murder mystery, but what ends up happening is it's a real killer, a serial killer, is executed on the night of the original Exorcist. And something wacky happens where that killer like then jumps into the body of Damien, the priest.
Right.
Which
raises more questions than it answers. Even in the book, it's like, so he just walked out of the morgue and nobody gave a shit. But that's what happened. And in the movie, it's even, oh, what's his name? Jason. Oh, what's his name?
Oh, like actor's name?
Yeah. Jason Miller, I think.
Has he been in anything else?
Well, he wrote a play about like high school football team that gets back together, and like that was like a Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, okay.
He's the
wasn't he a boxer, or is the character a boxer?
The character was a boxer.
Okay, because he kind of looks, he's got like a Rocky vibe.
Yeah, Jason Miller played Father Karras. He's also the son-in-law of Jackie Gleason. He married Jackie Gleason's daughter.
Oh, is he the father of the guy from Speed 2?
Yeah, what's his name? Jason
that
Patrick?
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know Jason Patrick is Jackie Gleason's grandson, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And in The Exorcist Part 3, look, it's not as good as Part 1, but it is scary. One of the best jump scares in movie history,
I know what you're gonna say. It's
is
the one
in the
hospital.
Exorcist 3. You're right. Actually, BuzzFeed just did a list of the best jump scares in movie
it
history.
It was on there?
It was on there.
Oh, wow.
And you know what? Even ruining it for you, it's still going to get you. Go on YouTube, Exorcist 3 jump scare.
It's where he has the huge clippers.
Right.
And he walks behind the nurse, right?
Right.
Because the camera cuts away when he's like right about to cut her head off.
Right.
And it comes so out of nowhere. It's so frightening.
It's a long shot.
Of a whole hospital hallway.
Of a hospital hallway. So you see in the really far in the depth of field, a nurse walking in between rooms. And it's a sort of mundane scene. It goes on for a while and there's no music.
It's one of those things where like the shot goes on for so long that you start to feel tense, like this is not normal filmmaking. Like we should have cut away by now.
Right. But I would say also that you're lulled into not thinking anything crazy is gonna happen.
Right.
And then the nurse walks out of one room, the camera zooms in very, very quickly, and you know, in filmmaking, you're never supposed to zoom. You're supposed to actually move the camera physically because when you zoom, you flatten out the image. But a very quick zoom is very jarring. So it zooms in. While it zooms in, you hear a loud noise. And the choreography is perfect. As she steps out and she's just making, you know, let's say there's four steps between one room and the next. She takes a first step out. Then she takes a second step out. Right behind her is a nun who's being possessed by the killer with these giant garden shears that are right behind the woman, like right on the back of her neck.
Yeah.
So she's going to cut the woman's head off. And the movie already sets up that these shears are very, very powerful.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like step one, step two, step three. We don't see it happen.
The scene cuts away right before she's about to like close the garden shears.
I don't know if that happens or if they just walk into the room.
No, it cuts away. I think it's like it zooms in. You see her with it and then it cuts away. I don't think you see them walk into the room.
Even us describing it, it will still scare
it's,
you.
It's really an amazing, good scare.
And just the visuals of it.
The sound is really jarring.
Yeah. And the idea of like it's right behind you, like your death
the thing,
is right behind you.
The nurse is just walking, not knowing that somebody's right behind her, about to kill her.
Right.
But you're watching it, so you, the viewer, feel uncomfortable because you're like watching somebody about to be killed, who doesn't know they're about to be killed.
It's really fucking scary, and the movie itself is kind of brutal. Like there's heads cut off.
Yeah, I remember in the book. One of the murders is, or a couple of the murders are children being killed. Definitely in the book, the first is a kid who's killed. They're all decapitated, I think.
There's one kill where the body has no blood in it. And they find jars of the blood.
Yes, yes, yes.
And they explain, like, the medical examiner explains, like, and not one drop of blood is spilled. And, like, it's been, like, this killer would have to, like, put a tube in you and then, like, pump your legs to get all the blood out, and then writes "It's a Wonderful Life" on the wall.
Yeah.
So I think it's really awesome because it's like it's an Exorcist movie, but it's also a killer movie.
But the weakest part, as we said before, is that because the book was Legion,
right?
The movie became an Exorcist sequel,
right?
So they had to put in the last act. The studio demanded they put in an exorcism scene,
right? And there is no exorcism.
There is no exorcism in the book.
And the exorcism scene in the movie is probably the weakest thing because God appears. And the first movie is very realistic.
Yeah.
And in the end of The Exorcist 3, like the exorcism is not working, and then like a shaft of light comes through the window and like saves the day, and it's like
Yeah, it's not great.
Like, it's like God. Like, I don't know.
Also, it's too...
I'm not against God.
In the first...
But it's like using God... Like, having... The first movie...
It's such a deus ex machina that it's literally deus ex machina. Like, right. It's literally God comes in and saves
and
the day.
God's literally just a beam of light.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first movie, although... You know, has a demon in it. You could also read the first movie as being about a psychological problem. Well, that's what makes the first movie and the first book very clever.
There are lots of clues in the first movie that it's not a real possession, like the fact that he sprinkles her with the water and tells her it's holy water, and she's like, "Oh, it burns," but then it's not holy water,
right?
And a couple of other things.
The book goes further. In the book, there's a lot of like the priest researching, and like he finds like. Real like scientific evidence for like cases where somebody begins speaking a language they never spoke. Like every weird thing she does
could be rationalized.
He finds a scientific reason for mm-hmm. And it's him coming to the point of like believing it.
And then what's emphasized even more it's emphasized in the first movie, but even more so in the book, is that exorcisms themselves it's wild, but
right.
In reality, like when they are performed, it's like a ritual that like takes days.
Right.
And like you keep at it.
And it's probably.
And in Exorcist 3, it like takes 2 minutes.
Right. And also, they have to introduce an exorcist. So they create a character of a priest that's not in the Legion book. And he really doesn't do anything in the third movie.
It was supposed to be Father Dyer.
Right.
But that actor who's a real priest.
Yeah.
Didn't want to do it.
Yeah. But. It's a good movie. It's a good horror movie.
It is good. It is really good.
The Exorcist Part 3 came out in 1990. Does it have a Fabio cameo? Yes.
I forgot all about that.
And also like some basketball player. Because there's a heaven scene, but...
Oh, yeah.
But wait. But don't get me wrong. It's a dream of heaven. It is. It's not actually heaven.
Yeah.
But don't be wrong. God does actually manifest at the end. But it sounds like we're shitting on it.
No,
it's underrated.
It is underrated.
And it'll scare you. I think it's scarier than the first Exorcist. I think the first Exorcist...
I don't think so.
I think the first Exorcist is an amazing movie. It's an amazing drama.
You've just seen it so many times, it's not scary to you anymore. The first Exorcist is fucking terrifying. The first time I saw the first Exorcist... I mean, I was a child.
Yeah.
But people who saw the first Exorcist as adults when it first came out were like, it's the scariest thing I've ever
seen. Yeah.
This brings us to mine, which is, so I did a cheat, and my entry is Exorcist 2 and 3.
So I don't like 2.
Nobody likes 2, including me. I don't really like it, but I think that it does interesting stuff
mm-hmm.
because it is so different from the first one.
Yeah.
And it's a notorious box office and critical bomb.
Yeah.
Like, it was literally laughed off the screen. And, like, they reshot the ending after it had already been released and re-released it or whatever. But it's basically about – it picks up 3 years later or so. And it's Reagan, who's the character who's possessed, who's now a teenager, is, like, in therapy dealing with the trauma of the possession because her psychiatrist doesn't believe that she doesn't remember it. And she's right, and that really Reagan is like repressing the memory of it. So it's got some like magical realism in it. There's a lot about like psychic ability.
Well, it goes the complete other way, right?
Yeah,
the first movie is very realistic.
Very realistic.
He was a documentarian before he made narrative. So the first movie is all like, let's take this fantastic thing and be as realistic as possible, even shooting it like it's a documentary. Where this movie, it's fucking
bananas.
Costumes and fakery and special effects.
There's like crazy dream sequences. There's a part where they fly on the wings of a locust. I mean, yeah. It's wild. But what
it's
I was going to say is well, they introduced this like fake thing of like there's like a machine that she puts on her head and the psychiatrist puts on her head where their minds can link up. And they can see each other's minds, and she could see her memories. Then John Borman said that he regrets it. He feels
John
like
Borman's the director. John Borman, of 2.
Second time I've done that. The director of 2, who also went on to direct Good Stuff. He directed Excalibur.
Yeah.
But he says now that he feels like he committed a sin because he didn't give the audience what they wanted, which was horror, because he was originally offered the first one.
Yeah.
And he turned it down because he said that he had a child and he didn't want to direct a movie that was so dark and was about involved the torture of a child.
Yeah.
And then when it was a huge hit. So then when he was offered the second one, he was like, okay, I'll take it if I can do what I want with it. And they said, okay. So he wanted to make it like lighter and have more, he called it like more joy, more meditation, more like magicality to it.
What you want to from make a it sequel like an, to The Exorcist. Yeah,
to make it like an antidote to the first one. And even if you watch not it, a at, horror at movie. The end, it's the same credits. Yeah. The same style of credits, but instead of it being a black background, it's a white background. So it's supposed to be like heal about like healing from the first one.
Interesting idea.
Interesting idea, but it's not a horror movie.
Right. So
it's just a weird kind of like a, I guess a sci-fi. I don't know. It's weird. It's not,
I guess it, good. I would call it sci-fi-ish for sure.
Yeah. But I think it's,
there's a lot of scenes of like overexposure or double exposure where it's like you see Linda Blair and you see Linda Blair as the possessed girl
and they're like wrestling each other, and also she quickly transitions into just Linda Blair with red eyes because she refused to put the makeup back on.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so there's another actress who plays her with like the cut up face from the first one.
Yeah,
but then she quickly transitions into just Linda Blair with like red lipstick and red eyes, and that's
very stylistic,
like,
that's too.
The demon. But it's because Linda Blair refused after the first one. She had to, like, she was like a young girl and she had to go through like hours of makeup every day and it was horrible.
She's hot shit.
She said she wouldn't do the second one unless she didn't have to put on the makeup.
She pulled the J-Law and she was like, I'm not going to be in this fucking Mystique full body makeup anymore. Yeah. Fucking CGI it.
So, I think it's got some interesting shit in it. It's interesting. Martin Scorsese likes it.
All right. You know, that's something I've read on IMDb,
but
I don't know if it's true.
I've read it elsewhere too. And you know who else really likes it?
Who?
Quentin Tarantino.
Fuck him.
Quentin Tarantino thinks it's more interesting than the first one.
It's long and pointless, so of course he likes it.
But no, Martin Scorsese apparently is a fan of it.
There were two endings. There was a happy ending where everybody lives, and then there's that got so panned, even at the premiere, people were like, fuck this movie. That
I think in the second ending, James Earl Jones' character dies.
Yeah, they made it darker, the second. It wasn't so, like in the original ending, like they walk away in the sunset, like, do-do-do-do-do.
Well, the score is really light and happy sounding. It's like church music-y.
You know, like they had a huge success, and William Friedkin didn't want to do another one, neither did the writer, but the studio was like, we're going to fucking do it. And then they just got someone else to do it. And so in some ways, The Exorcist Part 3 is the true Part 2.
Yeah. If it were today, they wouldn't even call it Exorcist 3. They'd make it a straight sequel and ignore 2.
Yeah.
And they would just call it The Exorcist 2019.
The Exorcist, comma, Legion, colon, Legion.
Yeah. William Friedkin has said that it's... Because William Friedkin's kind of like an outspoken guy.
I think he's an asshole.
He is an asshole. I was trying to be like nice. But he said like it's a piece of shit and it was directed by a person with a demented mind. He kind of sounds Trumpy when he talks. And he was like, the person who directed it's got a sick mind. It was a horrible movie. And he's like, it's so bad it makes my movie seem worse. He was like an abusive director. Ellen Burstyn has no nice things to say about him.
Right. Because he like... fired guns and like
he fired gun. He fucked up her back for life.
Yeah, like
in the scene where she's
that's pulled, not charming.
She's pulled backwards. She had already had a bad back, and she was like, "Take it easy." And then she's like, "He told the person like pull it really hard because we want to see real pain." And when she's screaming in pain, that's real pain you're seeing on the screen.
Cool. He made a movie in 2011 that I fucking despise called Killer Joe that has Matthew McConaughey in it. And like there's a scene where Matthew McConaughey makes this young girl like fillet. Like he has a chicken wing and he holds it in front of his dick and he's like, eat this chicken wing. And it's like, it feels very 60s in that it's making misogyny seem like sexual liberation.
Like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yeah. Or like MASH. You ever see MASH, the original MASH?
The movie or
yeah,
the show?
Yeah.
No.
The movie. They make sexually assaulting people like somehow it's like part of the sexual revolution. And like, now we look back and go, this is wrong.
Like Porky's?
Yes.
Okay.
So fuck William Friedkin. I mean, what is it? The French Connection's good? And The Exorcist is good.
Yeah.
That's fucking it.
Let's see. Let's pull up his IMDb. John Borman, as I said before, has made some good movies, I think.
Did he do Deer Hunter, John Borman?
Yes.
Are you sure about that?
I'm saying it with authority, so.
I'm not hearing authority.
French Connection was before The Exorcist.
Yes, it was.
French Connection, Exorcist, narrative movie. Boys in the Band. That's a good movie.
Well, you know
He made Cruising in 1980.
But here's the crazy thing. Boys in the Band is considered like a queer iconic film.
And then Cruising
is like the most homophobic later, movie ever.
Yeah. Cuz
Cruising there is a serial killer in the gay nightclub scene. So what Al Pacino goes undercover as a gay man going to leather bars to try to find this guy.
And then he ends up being a killer at the end or something?
Yeah. Well, like, it's one of those things where it's like queerness is equated with insanity.
Yeah. And evil.
Yeah. But then he also then made Boys in the Band, which is kind of crazy.
Let me pull up John Borman here. Hold on. John Borman made Deliverance. Not Deer Hunter. Deliverance is what you're thinking.
Oh,
of.
Deliverance. Yeah, that is what I was thinking.
Oh, he also made Zardoz.
Zardoz, the classic Wizard of Oz takeoff with
a naked
Sean Connery.
Sean Connery. Exorcist II, Excalibur.
I like Excalibur.
Queen and Country, The Tailor of Panama, Hope and Glory, The General. I don't know any of these movies.
I haven't revisited Excalibur in a long time, though, so I don't know.
He's received five Oscar nominations. Hope and Glory apparently is well received. All right, anyway, what's your next one? This is another crossover, right? Because I have this one on my honorable
and
mentions.
And this is the end of us crossing over. Yeah, we're going to get into fresh territory. 2010, The Year We Made Contact, which is the sequel.
I wonder how that's going to sound.
It's going to sound great. It is a sequel to the Stanley Kubrick classic 2001. And the Stanley Kubrick film is a tone poem. It is long. Most of it has no dialogue.
Unwatchable.
And when it does have dialogue, the dialogue is incidental. It doesn't mean anything. It's all just figurative representation. Mm-hmm. But also when you walk away from it, you're like, what did it all mean? I always fell asleep watching it until last year I saw it at Alamo Draft House with the intermission, which I think is very needed. Need that intermission.
That long, they should bring back intermissions for really long movies.
Oh my God. Tarantino would do good with an intermission.
Forget it.
No, the intermission's good because you're kind of like, what did you think of the first half? What was that? What did you this mean? What did that mean?
It's a good thing. I don't know. Old movies used to have them.
Yeah.
Sound
but for
music.
A movie that heady, it was really good. But 2010, which is directed by Peter Hyams, who was just a sort of, I forget what he directed. I'll look him up. It is a sequel. It's based on the second book by Arthur C. Clarke. And it more directly deals with the Cold War, which is sort of the background of the first book and movie.
Which really came to a head in the 80s.
Right.
The movies, even though it takes place in 2010, is very, very a big reflection of the 80s.
Yeah.
You know,
well, the
tension.
Idea is that the Cold War keeps going, where it ended in 91 is the official end of the Cold War?
Yeah, I guess. I believe so.
Yeah, because you have Russian cosmonauts and American astronauts on the same ship. And they're sort
and
of working together.
And their captain is Helen Mirren giving a great performance.
Yes.
One of her earliest roles,
but she's
I think.
Doing a Russian accent, which I think now people would find problematic.
I don't know. Like, Meryl Streep does accents all the time.
Yeah, that's true. But I feel like someone would be like, why can't you give it to a real Russian
accent?
Somebody
would be offended by that, for sure.
It is a sequel. It has the same aesthetic. It's just
it's
more...
the same studio.
Yeah. And some of the same actors. Not Roy Scheider. Roy Scheider is... is taking the role from someone from the first movie.
Cara Delia shows up in it, doesn't he?
The guy who plays Dave.
Yeah.
Open the pod bay doors. Yeah, he shows up in it.
Because I remember him being like, hello. Like, he sees
him. Yeah, he's even in the trailer. Yeah, it's a sequel, but here's the thing. I think why people shit on it is the first movie is this like amazing piece of Stanley Kubrick art, and the second one, it's a really great sci-fi movie. It's got dialogue, it's narrative, the dialogue pushes the story along. It is more of a movie what you would expect from a movie, but it still is a sequel to the first movie, and I think
it
pushes the idea further.
If you watch the trailer has got a lot of references and nods to 2001, and it's got the same music, which, like you said earlier, is very reminiscent of it's very similar to the Dr. Sleep trailer that we just got.
Right, it's like, whether it's good or not, I feel like people are going to shit on it because it's a sequel to a classic Stanley Kubrick movie.
Right, but it's, the Dr. Sleep trailer is so, like, marketing itself as a sequel to the Stanley Kubrick Shining.
Right.
I don't know. I think 2010 is a great movie. It's I think if it were not, I think if it were a standalone movie, it'd probably get a better. I think it was actually pretty well reviewed, but it just was a box office bomb.
Peter Hyams directed End of Days from 1999. That's the movie with it's like a devil movie with
coincidentally one of the thousands of movies inspired by The Exorcist.
Well, it was 1999 and it was like Turn It Upside Down, man. It's 666. Wow. It's Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mm-hmm. He did The Relic, he did Sudden Death, Time Cop. Those are two fucking what do you call it movies. Jean-Claude Van Damme. Oh, he did Stay Tuned starring John Ritter.
Oh my God, I haven't thought about that movie in 20 years.
That's a crazy movie.
That's, he's in hell, but it's all TV stations, right?
Right, you know who the devil is, right?
Who?
Real life child pornography viewer, Jeffrey Jones.
That's the principal from Ferris Bueller?
Yes.
Oh boy.
And the father from Beetlejuice.
I remember there's a nod to Three's Company in it.
Oh yeah. Don't think they didn't do it. So I think 2010 is really a good movie. It people don't talk about it, but it's a good movie.
It is. I'm looking now at like how it was reviewed at the time, mm-hmm. and it was pretty well reviewed actually. It has like 70% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Well, we've talked before about the phenomenon of like why a movie remains in the zeitgeist and why it doesn't.
Yeah, I think this one was just forgotten.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess there's various factors for every movie that's forgotten or remembered.
Yeah.
Because there are some great movies that are great movies.
If it still speaks to people, like, you know what I mean? Like if it transcends the time that it's made.
Yeah. By the way, the theme of this episode was my idea. We didn't say that earlier.
Yeah. We said it in the first recording, but I guess Anthony needed credit.
I need the credit.
He was like, we got to go back and say that.
So now I think we're in fresh territory.
Yeah.
For God's sakes. Book of Shadows, Blair Witch 2.
Oh, fuck you. So why?
All right. So here's...
It's not a found footage movie.
This is what I was about to say. I was right about to say this when you were like, oh my God, we haven't been recording this entire time.
Oh, shit. We haven't been recording again. Oh, is it real?
I respect the fact
that...
I'm sure it's not good. I mean, I did see it actually semi-recently. It was on TV in the middle of the night, and I was watching again. I was like, oh, this isn't so bad. I respect the fact that the first one was found footage, and they were like, for the second one, we're going to do something different. And we're going to make it...
But the different thing was the more easy, typical thing.
But the movie Blair Witch Project exists within the universe of Book of Shadows, which I think is interesting. Because it's about the fandom around Blair Witch. And people believing that Blair Witch was real.
Right. For our younger listeners, you're not going to believe this.
A lot of people believed, yeah.
You're not going to believe this because this was early internet and people really believed this found footage movie.
The first time we saw it, you and I saw it together with our cousins and everybody, yeah. We all thought it was real.
Right.
And everybody thought it was real.
America
and I remember seeing
it was
Heather Donahue on a talk show and being like, oh my God, it is fake. She's alive.
Yeah. America thought it was real, folks.
Yes, and that's the thrust. That was the original concept of Book of Shadows. The original, I mean, everybody always says this to cover up for their shitty movie, but yeah. Apparently the screenwriter, whose name I don't have right now, has said that his original screenplay was much better and it was much more focused on that. That the fan culture.
Yeah.
And how easily the public can be duped into believing
something. Yeah,
yeah. So, and some of that is still in it.
Yeah.
And I just also think that it's got some parts in it that, I mean, it's not a great movie, but I think it's interesting. And it's got some parts in it that are genuinely scary. Like when they see the footage of themselves killing the other campers.
Yeah.
And they have no memory of having done it. And then they all realize at the same time that they're murderers. That's really scary. I think that's an effective sequence.
Yeah, and they don't show the witch. They continue. But you do see more supernatural shit.
But remember at the end, the wife is like possessed by the Blair Witch, and then they hang her.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then when they're watching the footage with the police,
yeah,
she's like, please don't kill me. What are you doing? I'm your wife. Wow. And then they kill her.
I feel like you're convincing me.
It's really worth a second.
I gotta go back.
It's
and
worth
look at
a,
this.
I mean, it's shitty, but it's worth the second watch.
I talked about Blair Witch in two episodes ago with Vin because we were saying there's a Blair Witch game coming out, which I'm excited about. Yeah. And we were talking about there was a third Blair Witch, a reboot a couple years ago, which was found footage, but I couldn't even finish watching it.
I was just going to say that one, I couldn't finish watching either. That one's actually supposed to be a direct sequel to the first one, ignoring the second one. And I would argue that the second one is still better than that third one.
I can't. I at least watched the second one. The third one. I think like the third scene, they're in a nightclub, and I'm like, this makes no sense. Why would you have cameras in a nightclub? Like, and just everybody was too pretty. They looked like models. Like the third one,
it was supposed to be Heather's brother going to find her.
Yeah,
it's a piece of shit.
You know, since we're looking things up on IMDb a lot this episode, let's look up the directors. Did the directors of Blair Witch ever do anything else?
I don't know.
The Blair Witch Project, 1999.
It really is hard, I would imagine, for people to believe now, or younger generations to believe, how many people believe Blair Witch was real. Like, found footage was just not a genre.
Now there's so much found footage. Now there's so many of them. No one would believe Chronicle is really about superheroes.
I remember us even watching it and you being like, I don't know, like, wouldn't their battery die?
Yeah.
Like, and us being like, I don't know, though. It does look so real.
Because, I mean, it was independent. So it wasn't like when you watch found footage movies now, it's good movie cameras that they just shake around to look shitty.
Like Cloverfield.
Right, exactly. Whereas like this really was just like a student film.
It was a video.
Where they just got a shitty camera. Like, yeah. It's not like post effects to make it look shitty. Like, it's just genuinely shitty.
Well, there was a time, and actually I was reading, when I was doing research for this episode, I was reading about what I was just talking about with the screenwriter's original idea.
Yeah.
And he said, one of the things he said was, it's amazing how scary it is that people believe things that are shot on video to be real.
Yeah.
Which kind of is kind of, I feel like that's kind of irrelevant because now, you know, we have so much fake shit that people fall for, like deep fakes and, you know, like,
yeah,
there's something to be said for examining like people falling for things that are meant to trick them.
By the way, the directors have done really nothing. I mean, I could give you some names of some shitty horror movies that I've never heard of.
Yikes.
Straight to Redbox things. But that was basically it. But, you know, another thing that's interesting about the first movie, which is it's almost like an improv game because, you know, the kids doing it knew that they were making a horror movie. You know, right. They knew that. But they
didn't know what was going to come to scare them.
Right. They didn't know what was going to come. They didn't, like, at one point, they lose the map. That was in the middle of the night. The directors actually stole the map. Like, literally, it was like a game where, like, they didn't speak to the directors. The director was like, okay, you're in this movie. Now go camping and film everything. And then, like, there's a scene in the middle of the night where, like, there's something outside. Like, the directors really just came up to them and started fucking with them.
And that's the part when they're running and they're like, what the fuck was that? What the fuck was that?
And there's one, and then at one point someone disappears and they had no idea who was going to disappear.
Yeah.
Right. And the directors just walk them up and like, come on, come on, come on. You're going now. And then the other actors walk up and were like, holy shit, one of us is gone. So there's some genuine reacting going on. It is, I think, I don't know if this is still true, but I remember at the time people saying it's the most successful movie ever if you look at how much it made based on how little it cost. Like, it cost like $1,000 to make or something insane.
Yeah.
And then it made a crazy amount of money.
And also, I was reading
about
it.
And it reignited that genre.
Yeah. The end, there's something so uncanny and scary about them just standing in the corner facing the wall.
Yeah.
That originally that was just supposed to be a stand-in, and then they were going to add something like CGI scary to it.
Yeah.
And then when they watched it, they were like, no, let's just keep it.
Yeah, I think I talked about that with Vin.
With them facing the corner because that's just scary.
Oh, you know what it was?
And you know what else? Remember on Sci-Fi Channel, there was that fake documentary about the Blair Witch that came out alongside the movie. Yeah.
Right. What happened with the ending was in the beginning of the movie, there's like they're interviewing townspeople and they're all actors.
Yeah.
And they're improvising. And one woman just improvises this story about she made the kids stand in the corner. And they actually filmed that after everything else. But they were like, you know what? Let's go back to the cabin and have him stand in the corner because the thing that she just improvised would be a good setup to that.
Yeah.
I gotta rewatch those first too. Maybe when I buy the video game.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm up now, right?
So you have, we each have one left, right?
Wait, let me see.
Or you have two left. And I had
have two left.
I had three honorable mentions, but we already talked about 2010. That was one of my honorable mentions. Go ahead.
I have two left. So I guess I've kind of been going in order now that I think about it. Okay. Let me look up the year this is. Okay.
Is this actually good or is it a piece of shit?
I think it's fantastic.
Do other people think it's fantastic?
Emilio thinks it's fantastic. Okay. No, I think some people have come around on this movie. I just got to find. From 1990, this is like my third movie from 1990. From 1990, The Godfather Part 3.
Oh, my God.
The Godfather Part 3. First of all, the most quoted line in The Godfather, which is, every time I think I'm out, they drag me back in. That's from Part 3. First of all, The Godfather Part 1 is the best Godfather movie. The Godfather Part 1, I think, is almost a perfect movie.
Godfather 2 is overrated, I think.
Way overrated. Because you've got the stuff in the past with De Niro as young Vito, which is interesting. And then you've got the stuff in the present, which is like very political. And
you know what else is super boring and sucks? The super cut of 1 and 2 together.
Yeah, that they show
on TV sometimes.
They put it in chronological order.
That's not... It doesn't do anything for the storytelling.
And three, one thing that's good about three is because they had less money, they had to make it present day. They couldn't make it in the past. So they had to age up all the characters. Like in it, Michael Corleone, played by Al Pacino, is in old makeup. And it's kind of good old makeup. Yeah. And it's sort of like, if you remember two, the big finale of two that shows like this character's completely lost his soul is that he kills his own brother.
Right.
He's betrayed by his brother Fredo. And even though the whole thing is supposed to be bullshit about family and family this and family that, because he was betrayed, he kills his own brother.
Right.
And what I like about three is like the fallout of that.
Even he never gets over that.
Right. Right. He never gets over it. And also in part two, as a way of sort of showing that Michael Corleone is losing his soul. He's very affectless. Mm-hmm. He's very sort of stoic. Whereas in three, you see the character, there's much more going on. There's much more emoting. He's sad. Mm-hmm. He's alone. His second wife, which was played by Diane Keaton, left him at the end of part two. So he's been alone for all these years. He's an old man. His son doesn't even talk to him. Mm-hmm. His daughter talks to him. He's just everything. He's lost everything. Like, I really love the scene in part three where they're at the Vatican and he goes into a confessional and he starts crying.
That's bananas, though, that like it goes all the way up to the Vatican.
Well, the first movie's organized crime, the second movie is politics, and the third movie is the church. Right. So it's supposed to be like corruption goes higher and higher and higher. Right. But I love the scene in three where he goes into the confessional and he's crying and he goes, I killed my own brother. I killed my mother's son. I killed my father's son.
I mean, he's great. He gives a great performance in it. Right. I would say one of the reasons probably that movie is shit on is because of Sofia Coppola. And I think that it would have been a better movie.
She's not a good actress.
She's not. She's a great director. She's not a good actress.
Yeah.
And I think that it would have been a better movie if they had kept... Well, Winona Ryder was originally supposed to play that part.
Right. I don't know if Winona Ryder dropped out.
She dropped out. I think she got pregnant and she dropped out.
She would have been better.
She would have, because she's a great actress.
Right. Yeah, but you know,
Sofia Coppola's a bad actress. When she gets
killed... Yeah, but she doesn't have a lot to do in that.
There's also the weird storyline of with her and
There's the incestual storyline with her and her cousin, played by Terry Benedict.
Yeah.
But you were just gonna say when she dies. Spoiler alert: she dies at the end.
Her performance sucks. But he's got a great performance.
He does this. There's this thing where he screams and then he screams again, but they drop out the sound, so you just see him screaming.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, I think the reason people don't like it is one, because of her. Two, because I think people had it out for Francis Ford Coppola at that time. I think people were like, fuck you for making this movie, fuck you for your daughter. Like, I think people were against him at that time.
And also, like, the first two were very 70s, and then this one came way later.
Right.
And then wasn't it originally supposed to be, like, The Death of Michael Corleone? It wasn't supposed to be called Godfather 3, right?
He wanted to call it The Death of Michael Corleone. Which would have been clever because he doesn't die until the very end.
Right.
But the idea is his whole life is like a death.
Right. It would have made it less like a part three and more of like an epilogue.
It really is almost like an epilogue.
Yeah. Also, fun fact. I'm not sure if this is true. You would know. But I've heard The Godfather Part 2 is the first mainstream movie to have
Part 2.
Right. Which then became the norm afterward.
Right. And it shows how much power he had, because when he made Part 2... They were like, you can't call it part two. People are going to think it's like the same movie. You have to call it something different. And he was like, no, it's part two. But then when he made part three, they were like, you have to call it part three.
Yeah.
And he wanted to call it The Death of Michael Corleone. And like, no, it has to be called part three.
That's interesting how that came full circle.
Yeah. But
Because it really isn't like a, like one and two really are like twin movies. Go together or something.
Very
well. Yeah.
And they're made very close to each other. Yeah, yeah, they're yeah. both made on the same kind of camera.
Yeah.
Three feels like a movie from the 90s, but I think, like I like we say, like the point of this episode, it's underrated.
Oh,
people
yeah.
people treat it like it's fucking dog it's shit. Not horrible. And it's not. No, it's not at all.
Bridget Fonda's in it, right?
In a yes, very small role. But barely.
Whatever happened to her?
That's another mini-sode.
All right.
So The Godfather Part 3, check it out.
Okay. So my number one.
Oh, boy. I'm so excited.
Is a hot take. And not because.
Wait, did you do your honorable mentions yet?
No.
Because you should do your honorable mentions before you all do right, number
so my
one.
Honorable mentions are. Funny, there's a lot of horror here. I guess because horror movies beget a lot of sequels. Genre movies in general have a lot of sequels.
Right.
Although one of them is not. So one of them is The Evening Star. The sequel to Terms of Endearment.
I like it.
It's on my honorable mentions because I think it's a pretty good movie.
It is a good
but
movie.
But it got totally shit on because Terms of Endearment's so great. And yeah. it's very rare to have like a sequel to like a dramatic film like that.
Right.
And then my other one is Nightmare on Elm Street 2.
Okay.
Just because it's got the interesting queer subtext.
But I think that has been embraced.
Yeah, it definitely has. All right, so my number one is a movie that most people don't even know exists.
Whoa.
And it's probably not very good, and I haven't seen it in a long time, but I still think that the concept of it is really, really, really interesting. And it is... Should I pull up the year? I feel like you've been pulling up the year on all of
yeah,
them.
Yeah, pull up the year.
Let me pull up the year. Hold on. Let me get on to IMDb.
Why don't you put a little work into this, Anthony?
Hold on, please. Okay, 1979.
Whoa.
Let's see. Who's the director? God, I really didn't do any work on this, huh?
It's all right. We're not here to fucking do work. This is Pop Culture Man Children, PCMC.
It is directed by Bill L. Norton, who I don't know who that is. 1979's More American Graffiti.
Wow. You know, I thought of that movie just because when I was thinking about my list, but then I went, no, I don't like that movie. That movie sucks.
I think it's really, really conceptually interesting.
It's like The Exorcist 2 where it makes a bold choice, but in the end, that choice does not work.
So do you remember the choice?
Yes.
So the first one is a classic,
mm-hmm.
and it's interesting because it all takes place on one night in right. 1962. The second one is, what if we did one night, but it's cut across 4 years?
Well, right, but also
of the late 60s and showing the rise of the counterculture.
But also, so you should point out that
it's New Year's Eve, 64, 65, 66, 67.
But the first movie, you should point out, it's one night, but it's four different storylines.
Right.
But so we're following yes, different characters right, doing independent things on one connected night. Evening.
This is
the same characters, but they're separated by both space and time.
Yes, and each one is a year apart. And what's interesting about it is at the end of American Graffiti, the first one,
yeah.
which most people don't even know there's a second one, there's a title card at the end that shows how each one of them turned out.
Yeah.
And in the sequel, you see how they got to that.
Right.
And then it ends with the same title cards
yeah.
from the first one.
And now
you know the context of how they got to. And one of them is that the guy dies.
In a car accident.
In a car accident. And you see him drive off into the night.
Right, and he's a car racer.
Yes.
So you're kind of waiting for him to die the whole time.
Yes, and then you end up not seeing it.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because it shows like there was such a, like when you look back on that decade, there's such a stark difference between the early 60s and the late 60s.
Yeah.
And the first one is so early 60s. And then this is interesting because it shows like Vietnam and it shows like the rise of hippie counterculture. And Mackenzie Phillips' character comes back, but this time she's like a drugged out hippie.
Yeah.
I just think it's really interesting. It's probably bad movie, but I think it's a really, really interesting
And there's some problematic concept. Stuff in it.
Yeah, sure.
The car racer guy in the first movie, he hangs out with
like a 14-year-old
Phillips.
Kid. Yeah.
And then in the second movie, he falls in love with a woman who doesn't speak the same language as him.
Right.
Which I don't know why people sometimes think that's charming. It's not. Yeah, it's not. Weird.
Wolfman Jack comes back for it. The Toads, Terry the Toad.
Yeah.
His whole thing is in Vietnam and it's him trying to get discharged.
Right, right. It's an interesting concept.
It's got some more great music from the later 60s right. in it.
But I think what makes the first one so exciting is that it's all these different stories happening on one night. Because it's been... That idea was then used in Dazed and Confused. That idea right. has been used since... And of course, the first one was directed by George Lucas.
Right. But anyway, again, I think it's like the definition of underrated. Right. I think it was totally shit on,
right?
But I think it's actually not as bad as.
And this is a mention. Say. This isn't your actual.
This was
one.
My number one.
Oh, that was your number
I
one.
I think this is when I was thinking. At least for now, I'm sure I'll think of more once the episode's over. But when I was thinking of underrated sequels, this one is the first one I thought.
Well, whenever we do a list show, I always that night wake up and go, "Oh, I should have said this."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like when we did, me and Emilio did like our favorite superhero movies. And I totally forgot Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which would definitely be on my top five. Yeah. But it just I just didn't think of it. So this is all sort of what I thought of this week.
Yeah, me too.
Okay,
the only cast member to not come back was Richard Dreyfuss. Refused to come back.
He also didn't do Jaws 2.
I don't think he's ever done a sequel.
Jaws 2...
sucks. That's not underrated.
It's a slasher movie. It's more violent and scary.
It seems cheaper. Like,
it's way cheaper.
It's one of those sequels that seems older than the original because it's such low quality.
The Universal Studios ride is based on the second movie, not the first.
Well, that ride is now defunct.
I believe in Japan it still exists somewhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. That's interesting.
Okay. So let me do my honorable mentions. So one is one that we already did. We did a whole episode on it, Return to Oz.
Yes.
So that's an honorable mention.
Okay.
Another honorable mention... and this is a pretentious pick, but I think it's actually very good. It's a movie. It's a French film called Stolen Kisses, which is a sequel to The 400 Blows. So The 400 Blows is a very famous French New Wave film about a little boy growing up in France, and his mother has this relationship with this guy, and it's just. It's very episodic, but it's also very melancholy. It's about a little boy, but and it's directed by François Truffaut,
okay.
Who is, you know, as a critic, he wrote A Certain Tendency of the French Cinema, which was like one of the essays that sort of started the French New Wave and the auteur theory.
Mm-hmm.
So 400 Blows is like a French New Wave classic, but what people don't realize is that character then appeared in four more movies. Like the character and always with the same actor. So the same actor played him as a little kid and then all the way up until him as an adult man.
That's interesting.
So Stolen Kisses is the second in the series, and this is about him. It's the third in the series. The second is like a little short film. But it's the third in a series, and this one is very romantic. It's about him falling in love with various women. And then what are the other ones? There's – let me see. I'm trying to remember all five of them. The lead character is Antoine Donnel, who is a writer in the movies. But most people see him as a sort of pseudonym stand-in for François Truffaut.
Mm-hmm.
It's 400 Blows, and then Antoine Colette, which is him with like a date with a girl. It's like a short film where it's a part of a vignette movie. Then there's Stolen Kisses, which is the American version. Then the fourth one is Bed and Board, which is about his marriage falling apart, which is actually a very depressing movie. And then
almost sounds like Before Sunrise.
It's a little bit because it's like let's meet this person every 10 years.
Yeah.
And also, the first one is a lot about his mother, and then the others are all about his love life. So it's a lot of, like, his mommy issues.
Mm-hmm.
The last film is called Love on the Run. And the last film, there's a poignant scene where he meets up. His mother's dead, but he meets up with his stepfather, who is super abusive in The 400 Blows, and it sort of helps him end his mommy issues. It's a really good... Those are all four very good movies. So my number one... from the year.
Oh, I have one more honorable mention I forgot
give it to me.
Psycho 2.
A dead stare.
It's also on...
like, it's interesting for sure.
It's on a bunch of lists of underrated sequels too. So I'm not the only one who thinks it. It's sure. It really is good. Rewatch it.
Isn't that the one where like the sister becomes the killer because she's obsessed with Norman being in jail?
Yes.
It's an interesting idea.
It's a lot of the same actors. It's Vera Miles.
I remember the one thing I really like about it is there's a shower scene where nothing happens.
Yes.
And it's a total fuck you with the audience.
Yeah. No, it's good.
Because you're like, oh man, here's the shower scene. And then really nothing happens in it. All right. I'll accept that. My number one is from 1985, Day of the Dead, which is the third in the Night of the Living Dead series.
That is a hot take because most people say Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, most people say Part 2 is the best, right?
Yeah.
Night of the Living Dead is the original, the classic. It's in black and white, independent film. Amazing. The second one, Dawn of the Dead, is in color, and it's about people hanging out. They're not in a farmhouse. Now they're in a mall, and it has a lot to do with consumer culture. Right. The third one is
a lot of military stuff, right?
They're in a military base underground, and it's half military guys that are like becoming violent and drunk and horny, and half scientists. Okay, and they are not getting along, and there's the threat of rape, and it's very, very scary. But it's more about the military-industrial complex.
Okay.
And it also features my favorite zombie in the whole series, which is Bubs.
He's the good one, right?
Well, he speaks.
Yeah.
But he speaks kind of like Frankenstein. He kind of like just...
They teach him how to speak?
Yeah, he says like one word at a time.
Well, isn't the military trying to use them?
Right. Well, no, the military just wants to kill them. The scientists, they're originally trying to figure out... It's supposed to be years after it begins. So the scientists are trying to figure out what caused... The Night of the Living Dead. What caused this thing to happen? But then one of the scientists goes mad and he thinks he could like train them. Mm-hmm. And that makes the military people angry.
So it's a direct sequel. Because isn't Dawn of the Dead kind of like a sequel / remake?
No, it's not a direct sequel. It's sort of a sequel. Even though we consider Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Land of the Dead, Diary of the Dead, Journal of the Dead as a series of six, really all of them
are standalone.
Yeah, you can see them as they're all a different idea. I think as zombies represent different things in all of them.
Yeah.
One of the things that I like that's complex about three is in Night of the Living Dead, zombies represent, depending on who you talk to, it either represents American sort of patriarchal ideology or the fear of communism.
Okay.
In the second movie, the zombies represent consumerism. But in the third movie, the military is the bad guy and the zombies are just sort of caught between them. So the zombies are not really good nor bad.
Okay.
And there's even a scene where the zombies kill and rip apart the bad guy of the movie, and the audience cheered when that happened.
Yeah.
And side story, one time I was...
The last one, by the way, is Survival of the Dead.
Survival. So yeah. Diary, then Survival.
Yeah.
The Land of the Dead, I think, is very good. That's the fourth one.
The two after I heard
are horrible. The two after are not very good. And I think Diary of the Dead is a found footage movie.
Yeah, I think so. It's like a blog type thing.
Yeah, and the, Survival is weird because it's like a Western, but with zombies.
Because
It's sort of like very long after, so it's like what would happen. I was going, I was going for an interview to intern on a independent movie. It's the only movie I ever interned on, but like these offices where a lot of production was going on. And so I was interviewing to be part of this movie, but there were also auditions, and the guy sitting next to me was the guy who played Bubs.
Oh, really?
From Day of the Dead.
Did you recognize him right away?
Yeah, I was like, that's Bubs. But I didn't say anything to him, and now when I look back, I think he was probably auditioning for some shitty commercial.
Yeah.
I could have made his day by saying, that character you played is really important, because I would compare Bubs to like Boris Karloff as Frankenstein. It's a really good performance. Because you feel... He makes you feel empathy for the zombies.
Right.
So, that's my favorite. I like it even more than Night of the Living Dead. I think Day of the Dead is... I think it's the best George Romero film, I think. And it's the best of that series.
Okay.
It also has a strong female protagonist. Where the first one...
was a black male protagonist.
Right, which everyone thought was very progressive, but the female character kind of like, she begins the film, but then she just becomes comatose. And later on, George Romero says, the thing I regret most is making her so weak. Mm-hmm. And then he even produced a remake in the 90s. And they made her, they changed her character entirely to make her strong.
Yeah.
So,
I remember that remake.
Yeah. I mean, the whole series is good, but Day of the Dead is... That's my number one.
Remember the Dawn of the Dead remake from the 2000s?
There's so many remakes and fake sequels and reboots because they never copyrighted the first movie. Like, you could go make a Night of the Living Dead movie right now and no one can sue you. It's public domain.
Isn't there like an Italian series to like Zombie? Aren't those supposed to be sequels as well?
You're right. It's a it's in the public domain.
And then there's Return of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
Is that a satire?
Return of the Living Dead. Okay. Here's the thing about Return of the Living Dead. Night of the Living Dead was...
By the way, that remake is from also 1990. 1990 was quite a year for film.
Oh, you bet it was. So Night of the Living Dead is written by George Russo, and it's directed by George Romero. George Romero goes on and makes Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead, Land of the Dead. George Russo splits with him, and he goes, I'm going to do my own sequel. And then he makes Return of the Dead, Return of the Living Dead 2. So literally the two creators of Night of the Living Dead split off and make two alternative...
That's interesting.
But the Day of the Dead... but the Return of the Dead movies are really more pastiche and funny... And interesting.
The first one is 1985, Return of the Living Dead. I remember it being kind of like goofy.
But in a cool way. I really like those movies for their own thing. They don't have anything to say.
And then there's like a Return of the Living Dead 2, which is weird. Because it's
right, that series kept going on. So that's my list for now. I'm sure I'll think of one later that I'll go, fuck, that should have been on it.
Yeah, me too, obviously. But
this is it for now.
It's been great recording this episode twice with you.
Yeah, I think the second one was better than the first one.
Yeah.
We had more energy.
Yeah.
So this is Pop Culture Man Children, PCMC. We come out every Wednesday. You can subscribe to Pop Culture Man Children anywhere podcasts are available. We come out every Wednesday. We have never missed a Wednesday. We have never missed a show.
Never.
I don't care what's going on in my life. I will fucking
let make the Amazon burn.
Fuck the Amazon. Fuck Hong Kong. Fuck
Amazon.com.
Fuck. No, don't fuck any of those things. But no matter what, I think this show keeps me sane. So I will always make this show. And it's my favorite podcast.
It's podcast. It's up there for me.
So Anthony, thank you for being here again.
Thank you.
We end every episode by quoting Animal from Muppet Babies, where he says,
go bye-bye.